Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Zombie Myths of Australian Military History, edited by Craig Stockings, Chapter 5. So we've done a series of these myths. They're intensely embarrassing for Australians, particularly, well, if they're not embarrassing for Australians, they're a concern because they probably still believe these myths and would do a disservice to them and their fellow Australians by insisting upon them. So we've done a series of World War One myths. One was that the Gallipoli or initial Turkish campaign was anything but a complete excursion into a war zone without a particular purpose. The second one was that by any sort of measure, Australians weren't all that special. Well, they were good in World War One, but they weren't something sort of superheroes, super efficient troops. Well, yeah, they were effective, but there's a whole lot of other reasons to say that towards the end of the war, other troops weren't equally as effective. Chapter 5, we get on to Australians versus the Italians. Now, here a piece of wartime propaganda still lives in the minds of people that the Italians were particularly poor quality soldiers, moreover, that the Australians were very high quality soldiers, and that this was due to the due to national characteristics rather than just effective training and preparation for a theatre of war, which was the latter. And of course, if that's the case, there's an impetus for us to change and actually look at our own training, our own practices nowadays. But if the former is believed that we are just naturally superior, naturally better, we can just sit back and just be conceited, forever conceited. And still, to this day, the sort of byline for a poorly organised organisation or something which is in disarray, we say, oh, that's Italian. It's quite racist. It's arrogant at this point in time. And really inappropriate nowadays, given that in order to make any sort of statements or any sort of observation, it's in the context of being rather learned. So here, this is Craig Stockings, and Craig Stockings, this is his own chapter. If questioned about military heritage, the average Australian, be it consciously or unconsciously, has the general impression, a vague feeling, that not only have Australian troops acquitted themselves well in past conflict, they are, at some level, natural soldiers. This is especially true of the collective memory of World War II. Australian success on various battlefields during that conflict at the time and ever since is usually contextualised by the notion of a natural or innate Australian combat prowess. The surprisingly pervasive an enduring idea that the diggers of 1940s were, by virtue of simply being Australian, somehow naturally superior to their adversary, be they German, Japanese, or most conspicuously of all, Italian. They were, after all, heirs of Anzac. Their pedigree made it so. In the words of General Ivan McKay, who commanded the 1st Australian Division to participate in a large battle scale during the war, quote, there is an idea the Australian is a born soldier and that, once given a weapons, he's all right. The purpose of this chapter is to debunk such misguided notion. Authenticity is no explanation for battlefield outcome. Australian soldiers of World War II were ordinary men. Their place of birth or nationality was no indication of martial potential capability. The roots of their success and their failures had nothing to do with the hazy conceptions of national character or ethnic inheritance. Being Australian was no consequence to their behaviour under fire. What they achieved, or what they failed to accomplish, the Australian troops in World War II, even in the context of their proudest and most significant achievements at famous battles at El Alamein and Kokoda, were not born soldiers, They were made into soldiers. The myth of an intrinsic Australian aptitude for soldiering is widespread and pervasive because at its heart, intertwined with social and psychological implications of the Anzac legend. Okay, I don't want that sentence up. Muck that sentence up. Indeed, Australia's official historian of World War I, Charles Bean, who's just a propaganda machine, went out of his way to make a link between the national character of the combat performance at Gallipoli on the Western Front from 15 to 18. Bede's seeds found fertile ground and the Anzac legend, with all its attendant myths, grew strong. Even as the first casualties mounted at Gallipoli, the home front was told that their country had attained nationhood or had come of age. With almost religious undertones, popular consensus agreed that Australia, as an infant nature, was baptised in blood. During the process, the social values held dear by the collective consciousness of the earliest 20th century Australia, mateship, loyalty, physical courage, self-sacrifice, irreverence to authority, and so forth, were informally but systematically codified into a national legend about the diggers. It was also a legend of idealized Australian masculinity, the quintessential male, with all the necessary warrior attributes attached. The Anzacs was so crazed, Rambo was no crazed Rambo-like killer, but when pressed into war, he would kill and kill well. His natural and ethnic heritage made him naturally better than most, especially those short, unhealthy, outdoorsy, degenerate Europeans. As a consequence, Australians of the 1940s, whether they recognised it or not, grew into a force-fed, a diet of Anzac imagery. That's what we have to really understand. It's not that you disagree with the propaganda. You have to acknowledge the fact that we've been force-fed this internal propaganda. In short order, the Anzac myth grew into an inescapable social force tied ever more closely to the core of national identity. This powerful symbolism was reproduced in schools, championed by Veterans Association claiming to represent a body of men at the heart of the legend, and reaffirmed on the 25th of April each year at various shrines, large and small, across Australia. As an indication of just how powerful and inescapable the myth soon became, historian W.K. Hancock admitted that after 1918, he lied about his age because he had not volunteered and wished to avoid the stigma of standing outside the Anzac paradigm. Even the word Anzac became sacred and legally protected under the Law Precautions Act, the War Precautions Act, and the Protection of the Word Anzac Act of 1920. So we have a law protecting the word Anzac. At times of crisis, societies fall back on national traditions. In 1939, I think 1932 was the Depression, 1939 was the start of the war. The only one available in Australia was the Anzac. The Anzac of that era stressed ethnicity and military achievement. The link was made and the association applied to contemporary subsequent interpretations of the next war. Given the purpose of this chapter, a case study is perhaps the most efficient way of demonstrating how national mythology has obscured accurate interpretations of Australian and military achievement in World War II. Why we seem intent, then and now, despite an abundance of evidence to the contrary, to tie ethnicity to battlefield performance. Now let us focus, therefore, on the first Libyan campaign, 1940-41. So this is the Australians versus the Italians. This is not a random choice. The Western Desert of North Africa was the theatre in which the Australian troops of the 2nd AIF to AIF first saw combat. It was there that the sons of Anzac were tested. If there was any substance to the interwar feelings of inherent Australian military prowess, it would no doubt make itself clear in the cauldron of desert war against the Italian enemy. On the surface, ensuing events seemed to prove the myth was founded in fact. In response to a ponderous Italian invasion of Egypt in September 1940, which got as far as the village of Sidi Barani, 95 kilometres east of the Libyan frontier, so they already managed to get 95 kilometres out of Libya. I think Libya was Italian. On the 10th of December, a British counter-offensive drove the invaders back across the border. On the 3rd of January 1941, the second battle of the campaign, the Australian 6th Division launched an attack on the Italian port village of Bardia, which was quickly taken for a loss of 130 killed and 326 wounded, with around 40,000 Italians taken prisoner. On the 22nd of January, Tobruk, further west, on the Crayen coach, was captured by the Australians, with another 26,000 prisoners taken. The retreating enemy was pursued relentlessly. By the 6th of February, the Australians had reached Benghazi. In 2 months, the Italian 10th Army had been badly mauled by a combination of the British 7th Armoured Division, and from Bardia onwards, the Australian 6th Division. It was an outstanding achievement. Perhaps the myth was right. Perhaps it's rather stupid because the Italians folded, the Germans came in. Perhaps the spirit and the heritage of Anzac was the decisive factor. Certainly, ethnically oriented explanations of these events offered over the following 6 years have been built on such foundations. It is important to note, for many on the home front, Australian troops embattled in North Africa as the embodiment of the Anzac legend. As the first significant Australian battles of the war, events in the Western Desert were focused on unmatched media attention in Australia itself, shaped by Anzac mythology. On the eve of the battle, the popular press expressed a level of expectation and confidence born of this legend, rather than an objective memory of the last war or a balanced consideration of the conflict it had. The amazing Australian successes, therefore, entered the public domain as a, quote, historic and well-orchestrated event received within the context of a pre-existing explanation. That's pretty amazing. I love that. For many, the reason for success had already been recorded by Beam. All that was changed was the setting. The connections were ever-present. The Sydney Morning Herald, for example, recorded how Australian troops, quote, broke through a fortified line comparable with strength to the Hindenburg line. Well, that's complete rubbish, obviously. Letters of congratulations from veteran groups and associations such as the Returned Services League and the Gallipoli Legion reaffirmed the link. The Australians won because they were Anzacs. This simple and powerful concept set the foundation for subsequent tradition and misinterpretation. Leaving aside press reports which exuded Anzac imagery, even official statements about the Libyan campaign tended to fall back on the idea of Anzac lineage and the innate combat prowess of a key determinant of success. Minister for Army Percy Spender broadcast from Cairo that Australians were, quote, deeply stirred now that our men are giving battle to the enemy, emulating the spirit of their fathers. They let the world know that such people can never know defeat. Oh, God. The official imagery was unstoppable. Anzac was strengthened by the efforts of the war correspondents. Chester Wilmot reported, quote, quote, the Australians never flinched. When their fire didn't check us, the Italians lost accuracy. And when they saw the bayonets, they cracked up completely. The outstanding fact, according to Wilmot, was, quote, that the men of the 2nd AIF have shown that they are made of the same fibre of the 1st AIF. The 1st AIF is the 1st World War. Equally, Alan Moorhead, with a strange fascination for, quote, barebacks burnt brownish black by the sun's muscles that bulged like tennis balls, argued that, he sounds a bit of a creep, these men from the dockside of Sydney and the sheep stations of the Riverina presented such a picture of downright toughness, with their gaunt, dainty face, huge boots, revolvers stuffed in their pockets, gripping their rifles with huge, shapeless hands, shouting and grinning, always grinning, that their mere sight must have disheartened the enemy troops. Oh, God, that's just disgusting. That's so embarrassing. Overall, the overwhelming majority of wartime observations and commentary fitted the mould described above. It looked to the Anzac myth and the ideas and national character or characteristics to explain and exalt victory. There were, however, some immediate voices of dissent, particularly from veterans who knew the true face of war and the reality behind the legend that had grown up around them. Spender was forced to speak against significant few that have been suggesting that quantifiable explanations exist for the huge numbers of prisoners taken so little lost. The argument, the minister suggested, quote, was entirely fallacious and was almost unjust to the men. It was nothing of the sort. Not only were such questions entirely valid, as this chapter will go on to detail, there were indeed such quantifiable explanations. A real problem for Spender and the wartime trend of ANZAC-oriented celebratory explanations he presented was they were based on faith and not facts. To some degree, taken in their context, Spender's ANZAC-oriented explanations and Moorhead's caricatures can be understood and even forgiven. There was, after all, a war going on. The propaganda value of the desert victories and the social political capital that could be drawn from them was considerable. If more could be milked from the event by harnessing it to the ANZAC legend, then so much the better. It was, perhaps, a time for high emotion, too early for objective analysis. What is far less excusable is the ease with which the post-war authors and historians accepted and propagated these types of interpretations after the war. In the opening volume of Australia's official history, The Australian of Australian Environment in World War II, published in 1952, Gavin Long perpetuated the ANZAC tradition of making Australian infantrymen equipped with the individual and collective tools of inherited national character the key determinant of victory. Subsequent military commentators and historians were content to follow the pattern set down, to some degree legitimised by the official history. In 1975, William Jackson, in the Battle for North Africa, 1940-43, went so far as to suggest that all Lieutenant General Richard O'Connor commanding the Allied forces in the Western Desert during the Libyan campaign had to do was point the 6th Division towards the Italian and all would be well. O'Connor, according to Jackson, at least, quote, has his faith perforce in the fighting spirit of Mackay's Australians. Again, the spirit of the ANZAC dominates. Roger Parkinson's The War in the Desert, which hit the bookstands the following year, not only agreed, but informed the readers that Australians' dash and daring was not only what counted, but was made them famous among desert fighters. The basic message was reinforced in the works of fiction. As early as 1944, example, Lawson Galsop, We Were the Rats, used his characters to ask and answer, quote, why do you think Australians are such good soldiers? I think it's because we play so much sport and get so much sunshine and we're always fit. And we're still going to the initiative. Of course, we as a nation are, I think, the second most overweight after the Yanks. We're completely overweight at the moment. I suppose that is. Plus an adventurous spirit. Australians, like Americans, have still got a virility of a young nation. And we don't have to depend, as the Tommies and Germans do, implicitly on our officers. Oh, God. Which is... it is true that we have such a small army. We train all the soldiers to basically operate without officers or NCOs. The average Australian, I think, is trained for 3 years versus 18 months or even 6 months for US soldiers. So by that time, they've been trained up to NCO levels. So we're just bringing, in fact, the entire units of NCOs overseas. And like we would, I think for Afghanistan, obviously the people who went over there was the first tour, but we wouldn't have a unit over there, a section, with at least a couple of people in that section, which that had been the third and fourth tour. Slightly a bit different from the Americans, which had fresh units. Of course, the Americans have got a lot more people going through. I think for Vietnam, we lost 550 people, all right, all out. But they included people with car accidents and sort of industrial accidents in Vietnam. So I don't know what the actual casualty was. In Afghanistan, there was 30. There's been 30 people lost. Just to give you a close view on it, by the late 1970s and early 1980s, decades of consistent ANZAC-oriented historiography had produced a type of uncritical conformity. And you can imagine in the schools, which is already out of date, so it's impossible to change them. In 1979, Brian Perrett, for example, concluded that the Australians in Libya had proven that, quote, like their fathers, were the best assault infantry in the world. Now, there were a few publications, however, that embraced the ANZAC-based explanation of the Australian success in the campaign more than Barry... I hope it's not the bulletin. I've just got to turn the page here. Than Barry Pitt's well-known work, The Crucible of War, Western Desert, 1941, which sells to this day in the Australian War Memorial. Oh, Pitt tells us that. Oh, God, this is... We were big men. It seemed that those who weren't well over 6 foot tall made up for it by being 3 foot wide, and if they were 3 feet thick as well, it was all bone and muscle. As if, good God. Rifles hung on their huge hands like boys' air guns. They handed light machine guns as though they were rifles. A column of marching Australians shook the foundations of the road. They were advancing giants. Huge under the flapping grey coats, their weapons held casually in their hands, their helmets pushed back, nonchalant, above their grinning, sand-blurred face equipment, bandoliers, shovels hanging apparently unnoticed from the slab-like shoulders as they trotted like friendly Neanderthals. Yeah. Which is true, that they did actually occupy Tobruk quite professionally for a while. It is hardly surprising, therefore, according to Pitt, Italian soldiers were morally shattered by the sight of these huge figures lumbering up their posts out of the gloom, cutting their way through the wire as if it didn't exist, firing their brands from the hip, tossing grenades into trenches and shelters like ping-pong balls. That's a quote. I don't know where the ping-pong balls quote's from. Oh, this is a quote. Oh, Pitt wrote that. Oh, my God. Oh. If Pitt set a new standard for inflating the time-honoured idea of natural Australian soldiery skill, bearing as a key ingredient in battlefield success in North Africa, his work no means represented any slackening of further attempts to inject ANZAC legend into the battlefield reality. Shall I say that when I was a kid, I used to go and sort of look after some old people, just for free after school, you'd go and do some gardening. And a couple of times we used to go to these people who used to, the rats of Tobruk. But they weren't like this. They didn't say anything like this. The 6th Division is imbued with the reputation of the 1st AAF and is desperately eager for action in the role of their fathers had performed best. That of shock troops, oh my God, which Australians were actually shock troops, obviously. A few years later, in 1987, Peter Badman went one step further in linking the events for Libya to the heart of stereotype Australian identity, contending that desert fighting somehow reflected the staunch spirit of belonging that the Australian inland had given the bush and urban volunteer soldiers. I suppose it's the same. You just can't get if you stay in the Australian desert for so long. Again, exactly how the Australian inland imparted its spirit into the division predominantly recruited from the large coastal cities is not all clear. The misguided tradition continues this day. Most recently, Peter Fitzsimmons' popular work has suggested that so keen were Bouquet's men for stand-up fight against the Italians in North Africa that many men felt, quote, short-changed that they hadn't already got one. Furthermore, without indication on what such condition might be based, Italian prisoners were apparently, quote, happy to be away from these wild men from the south, insanely charging at them with death and destruction pouring out of every barrel. Oh, that's embarrassing. Just cut our blokes loose and whops on the whops. What, Western Oriental people? He contended, and it will be over very quickly. I should say that... bushies, the people, if you in a training unit with the farmers and stuff like that, they tend to know sort of like small details like how to tell directions or animals or like simple things like When you leave a campsite, you emu bomb through it to look for things, anything that's dropped. That's really, this is not, these are not hardened people, but there is a distinction between Australian rural soldiers, but it's not necessarily on the military front. It's more on the sort of how to eat out in the bush, the very simple bushcraft. Okay, the imagery involved in such graphic, evocative, descriptive purposes would be entertaining if the consequences were less insidious. I know this is that's what I feel. It is, you can laugh, you in podcast land, that Australians are so stupid. I'm actually concerned that a lot of Australians believe this. The more words spent over time in this style of narrative, the more difficult it becomes to get close to what actually occurred in Libya. At the risk of reducing McKay's men to the level of mere mortals, as far less dramatic combination of real and objective military factors was the true secret to their success. To some extent, Robin Gester's comprehensive study of the quote, heroic theme in Australian war writing helps to contextualize this problematic historiographical phenomenon theoretically. Gester argues that in such cases, the writer's inattention to record events has been subverted by the temptation to manipulate them for the propaganda, political, cultural, philosophical doctrine. Yeah. Now, and look, I think it's just not military stuff. I think people all over Australia is really suffering this all over. We don't have necessarily, we have poor leadership in the domestic military organisations, but we also, in the education organisations, their understanding for how things work. It's awful. Okay, I haven't explained it very well. But the idea is that because they're so eager to push their own political wheelbarrow, they're not actually looking at the real facts, which I, as a researcher, would like. The doctrine of the Anzac. The doctrine is Anzac. The tendency of Australian works concerning the first Libyan campaign is therefore to be propagandist, intentionally or otherwise, in promoting nationalistic sentiments. You know, it's just, yeah, it just is a propaganda festival. So how do we steer us from a propaganda festival away from the abyss of a propaganda festival? Many authors have become what Gretzer called publicity agents for the digger as an exemplar of heroic, radical, racial characteristics, rather than disinterested observers of human conflict, as Jane Ross has suggested, to authors imbued with or victims of Anzac sentiment. The objective truth of events is perhaps less relevant than expressing an interpretation of the essence and distillation of those truths. By a reactive, cumulative process, a tendency towards consistency is formed. At the heart of the myth is that the Anzacs won because they were Anzacs. This is a fairy tale. Let us focus on replacing traditional Anzacs with ethnically oriented explanations of Australian success in the Libyan campaign with something a little less colourful but a lot closer to reality. There were, in fact, a host of real, measurable, objective, relatively military advances held by the allies of the Italians in the Western Desert during the campaign, which probably account for its outcome. Such factors as logistics, equipment, intelligence, and air sea power, all vital parts to play. One of the most important, however, especially as it strikes right at the heart of the misconceptions about the natural Australian military aptitude, concerns the issues of training. Okay, and this is the crime, because we are ignoring training now. We really need to train for conflicts or get intelligence for conflicts. We say, oh no, it's all right. We're really going short, being evil before. Senior, okay. The Australians of the 6th Division were relatively well-prepared, well-trained for battle. Their Italian counterparts were not, and it counted. A woefully inadequate system of individual and group training hamstrung the Italian army through the early stages of the war. In the 18th century, the Russian Field Marshal Alexander V. Zhirkov reputedly advised his troops to train hard, fight easy. Italian units in North Africa were trained ineffectively, if or not at all, and fought poorly as a consequence. Senior Italian officers were seemingly oblivious to the importance of unit and subunit training, and had been for quite some time. From 1918, the Italian army suffered a decade of reorganization and rationalization during which field training was almost all but absent. By the 1930s, while the situation had improved marginally, there was still a long way to go. By mid-1937, for example, the German Minister for War, Field Marshal Werner von Blumberg, himself an infantryman, visited Italy for 8-day military inspection. During the tour, Blumberg saw and identified fundamental weaknesses within the Italian combat training system. Pre-war military instruction for Italian troops followed a strictly defined set of routines designed to turn out soldiers of uniform standard. As a mass exercise, however, it was by necessity limited and superficial. In winter across Italy, military training simply shut down. Indeed, in early 1939, the German General Staff penned a memorandum on the level of training efficiency across the Italian army. It was so unflattering that Hitler ordered it withdrawn from circulation and destroyed, let his officers gain too much insight into the true nature of their future allies. After witnessing some high-level Italian military manoeuvres on the eve of the war, Mussolini's son-in-law and General Foreign Minister Count Giuseppe Ciano concluded privately that the fascist army was in a pitiful state. The situation for Italian formations in North Africa reflected a wider circumstances. Even after the declaration of war, training was conducted in this theatre on a peacetime basis. It was generally restricted to barracks work and superficial garrison activities designed to please the eye rather than prepare the troops for rigors of battle. Field exercises and detailed tactical instructions were neglected almost entirely. By the time the Italians' invasion of Egypt began in September 1940, a little over half of all the troops involved had received any formal military instruction. Newly arrived Italian conscripts had been given none at all. Oh my God. The instruction for the Italian regimental officers was little better. Any time a unit had to move off the coast road, for example, its commander was forced to request a land navigator, which specialised training to read the compass and navigate the desert, be sent forward from headquarters. By contrast, all Australian troops were taught to navigate, not only by map, by compass, by a limited degree, by stars. That's still true today. Incredibly, officers in the various arms within the Australian, Italian formations assembled, practiced any form of combined operations. Officers of several years' service captured in Libya claimed never to have been involved in a single large-scale exercise involving all arms and air support. Rommel later identified this particular training gap as a key risk behind most of the Italian defeats in North Africa in this period. What would Rommel know? At the lowest level, individual Italian soldiers were often pushed into the frontline service without adequate knowledge of even their own weapons. Private V. Romano of the 23rd Corps, for example, remembered arriving in North Africa and being assigned an anti-tank gun, the first one he'd ever seen. Some infantrymen entered battle without ever having fired their rifles. Even those who had been lucky enough to practice did not necessarily benefit from a systematic program of instructions. According to his record of service, after 6 years in the army, Private B. Botti, for example, was still rated a third-class shot. Worse, you know, obviously he's a bad shot, and he's able to survive 3 years there, 6 years. Worse, in rare cases, in the unit and subunit training programs were carried out, the lessons were outdated. Corporal G. Lupi recalled his training was based on the 1814-18 war, as the lessons of Ethiopia or Spain were not yet translated into training of the troops. It was enough to convince Field Marshal Kesselring that the conscripted Italian soldiers in North Africa, quote, not being so pitifully naive and easily satisfied, the consequences would consist not only for a defeat, but also a mutiny. There was a range of rational reasons behind the paucity of tactical training in the Italian units before the war, and even once hostilities commenced. None of them involved ethnicity. There were few large group training grounds in Italy, for example, and a lack of available equipment and ammunition did not help. In addition, promulgated, any lessons learned from operational experience incorporating modern training techniques were difficult propositions given the functional shortcomings of the military bureaucracies and the low level of education and literacy among the troops, especially in conscripts from the south. I must admit, I've spoken to a few people, educated Italians, talking about their relatives in southern Italy. This is nothing against them at the moment. In an attitude that has yet to receive research required to provide a comprehensive explanation, it is a pervasive sort of way Italian officers seem to have chosen not to train their men under the misguided assumption that, under fire, intuition and individual valour counted for more than well-practiced drills. As there were almost universal disdain for the cadet and the unit training for fear of the focus on techniques and procedures might detract from the fighting spirit and essential improvisation. As preposterous as this proposition seems, and is, it's nonetheless the philosophical justification for largely untrained Italian troops in North Africa, i.e. they were prisoner of war ready. The only real exceptions to the rule were the Italian artillerymen. By virtue of the technical and mathematical nature of the job, these soldiers tend to be drawn from better educated class of officers and men. Their role also helped artillery officers to avoid the infatuation with the fighting spirit or the elan that plagued their infantry and armoured colleagues. If shells were going to be fired on land, the intended real instructions were essential. As a consequence, Italian artillerymen were trained more comprehensively than any other branch of the service deployed in North Africa. In contrast to feelings expressed by the contemporaries in other arms, Gunner U. Telebandini recalled as being given able training which provided for good relationship and understanding with our superiors. It was no coincidence that the Italian artillerymen in the first Libyan campaign were described by their adversaries as the most dangerous and tenacious of their foes. Major Fred, Chilton of the 2/2 Battalion 6th Division, believed there was no question the Italian gunners were well trained to determine troops prepared to fight out to the last. Another Australian, Major H.C.D. Marshall of the 2nd 7th Battalion, was equally adamant. We had every respect for the skill of the Italian artilleryman. A British artilleryman, Gunner T.L. Tutt of the 101 Royal House Horse Artillery, once came across an Italian battery that had been engaging his own. He noted they died at their guns, and given the scattering of bodies close to the fighting positions, they must have remained in action until our infantry tanks and Australians overran their gun pits. The links between proper training and combat effectiveness is clear. If Italian artillerymen fought well in comparison to their arms, it was a direct consequence of having received more training. Good point. Take a while to actually make these points, doesn't it? This is a whole problem. You can do an Anzac ceremony, and that's over. Sing a few songs, do an ode, look serious. But if you've got a complicated point like this, you need a book to write it in. And he's actually rather smart, because he has not just written this out. He's got 10 books to make you feel that this is not just an isolated case. Where the Italians fought during the first Libyan campaign without a foundation of effective instruction, the Australians were more than well prepared. Major General McKay's division was thoroughly trained and in close to perfect condition. Despite careful reservations of some of its leaders, 6th Division was as ready as an untested formation could ever reasonably expect to be. In words of Gavin Long, it was doubtful whether succeeding 5 years any Australian force was fitter for battle. Certainly proper training and military routine took time to incalculate. The number of soldiers sent home from the Middle East as incorrigible or untrainable in late 1914 was a testament to that. At the same time, McKay's men had almost 15 months of hard, systematic, sequential, well-planned training to prepare for the first trial of arms, a luxury all but unparalleled by any formations anywhere in the war. It's also worth noting that the 6th Division enjoyed a considerably longer period of training than was given to its predecessors in 1914 before going overseas. Moreover, in contrast to the Italian training philosophies, the Australian military regulation laid down specific and detailed responsibilities for unit commanders with regard to training their officers and men. It's still, we've got a strong training command here. This spirit was embraced across the General O'Connor's command. Quote, a well-trained unit, he observed, pays dividends every time in the way it gets things done and saves itself casualties. Colonel John George Vassie, the senior administrator of Headquarters 6th Division, described the idea that Australians were born soldiers requiring only a change in civilian uniforms as a woefully ignorant superstition. Many other Australian commanders within 6th Division, such as Brigadier H.C.H. Robinson and Lieutenant Colonel Viv England, went on to develop well-earned reputations as being sticklers for proper training. I think the Leslie Moorhead, which is my superhero, was train. He had three philosophies of war, and it was all the same word. As soon as the Australian troops disembarked in Palestine and later Egypt, the regimes of collective training were set down with the 6th Division were realistic, comprehensive, rigorous, and intensive. Early training programs in the Middle East followed traditional sequence of activity, progressing from section to battalion levels by May 1914. Particular focus was given to minor tactics and small group procedures. From there, brigade-level activities commenced from August 1914. Two of the 6th Division's brigade commanders, Arthur Tubby Allen, so he went back to the Kokoda Trail, poor man, and Stan Savage believed that their formations were ready for action. Collective training programs for the Australians culminated in late 1940 in a series of divisional exercises, after which the formation's Chief Operations Colonel Frank Berryman described the 6th Division as fairly expert, while McKay concluded that his division had achieved the cohesion and cooperation that will wield us together as a perfect whole. At the same time, Australians continued to draw valuable individual training from various British Army schools, including the Staff College at Haffa, which is in Israel, which they passed on through informal courses run within units. Senior officers courses at the Middle East Tactical School, and most extensive instruction yet encountered by both Australian regimental officers, was a particularly important training opportunity. One key emphasis was the focus on combined armed operations in open terrain. In total, some 500 officers and 2,200 of 6th Division's non-commissioned officers benefited from such training formal courses before ever being tested in combat. All the while, the ingrained lessons and experiences on the Western Front were informally inculcated into the division by veteran soldiers and leaders, which is all their leaders were World War I veterans. Under such conditions, the keen amateur force which landed in the Middle East was rapidly transformed into a more professional organisation. The importance of individual and collective training was emphasised so much in Palestine and Egypt that by the same time the 6th Division began moving towards the front line, soldiers were openly complaining that life seemed to be an endless series of routine marches, PT, which we still say PT teaches, physical training exercises, and mock battles instead of real ones. Many began to lament internal exercises on the Hebron Hills, with combat drills practiced until they became automatic. One junior officer warned that after the last division exercise in late 1940, that if we have any more of these mock battles, the men will begin hoeing into each other with their bayonets. There was no question that the men were heartily sick of exercises and endless indecisive war between Northland and Southland. Okay, that's interesting, because there's a bit various. There's people who study fake American, fake Australian enemies, which had fought under the Empire's eye in Palestine, the headwind near Cairo, and on the fringe of the Western Desert. McKay's troops felt themselves doing more ready. In their eyes, training had proceeded as far as it could be called outside the actual combat, and they were chaffed at continuing training cycles. The luxuries of such complaint was beyond their adversaries. Nor did the training stop, even as 6th Division surrounded Bardia in preparation for its first significant engagements. Constant patrolling in the front of the Italian perimeter ensured that most junior commanders gained a good idea of what they faced, along with the settling effect it had of having been under fire before the battle commenced. On the eve of the first action, 6th Division actually built a scale replica of the break-in point, so the engineers could practice pulling down the anti-tank ditch and building tank crossings, a particular example of the extent to which Australian officers were determined to prepare their men for action. On learning of the unit's whole role, Lieutenant Colonel Ern Ither directed his men to practice night movements like that which would be required on their approach to the march to battle. On the 31st of December, Ether and his whole unit rehearsing movements over short distance at a slow rate of 100 metres every 2 minutes, just as they would have to move in the coming assault. And that's one of the things that I saw remember training at. Another exercise on the night of the 1st of January practiced paces, bearings, distances and directions. By day, Escher's battalion formed into mock assembly area and rehearsed moving the same distance through a fictitious start line before advancing in the same direction, for the same distance, the same time of day, as a real assault. They breached fake wire obstacles and led companies charge the gap. Ether was determined that, this being our first engagement, the initiation of the 2nd IAF into battle, we would not risk a setback. At divisional headquarters, Berryman later admitted, we were anxious to avoid the confusion of the Anzac and Fromelles and Poses, or the 1st Bullet Corps, so our preparation was thorough as we could make it. The wider point was that the lavish training opportunities presented themselves, seized upon and well utilised their commanders, would have bewildered the men they met on the other side of the wire. The net result was a glaring training mismatch between the Italians and the Australians, as wide as the separation with respect to their basic tactical proficiency. The troops faced by the 6th Division during the campaign seemed unable to grasp or apply even the most elementary combat procedures, even at an individual or small group level. The issue of Italian tactical incompetence was highlighted in one of the very first large-scale Italian attacks in North Africa, against the town of Shalom, S.A. Salem, during the initial Italian invasion of Egypt. British soldiers were astonished to watch Italians form up in columns and squares as if on parade, waiting for an order to advance. The parade ground precision made wonderful targets for British artillery and air attack. Indicative of his own low opinion of the tactical competence of his officers, on the eve of the advance, General Mario Berti, in command of the Italian 10th Army, felt it necessary to explain to his corps commanders how to employ their guns, and even to what formation their tank squadrons ought to move. Further, expecting his troops to panic and fire, Berti directed attacking columns to be led by commanders in whom confidence may be placed, capable of repressing promptly any signs of disorder. His subordinates would be fine, Bertrand assured him, if only they had the calmness to hold fire until the enemy approached near enough for effective action. Bertrand understood the true level of soldierly skill within his army. If further evidence of the glaring Italian tactical deficiency was required, it came during the push to and defence of Sidi Barani, leaving aside the fact that the Mattelli group, a composite division, sides formation got lost en route to the start line, that the subsequent advance was slow, unenterprising and vulnerable. In terms of defensive layout, the various Italian camps constructed at Sidi Barani were anachronistic in the form of their functionality. They were not mutually supporting, lacked depth, and defending artillery pieces were immobilized by sandbars built around them. Inside the camp, trucks and supplies tents were crowded together as if inviting bombardment. Moreover, there should never have been an unfortified 18-kilometre gap between Niba and Raba camps for the British to exploit during the successful counterattack. In a similar vein, the 7th Armour Division pursuit from Sidi Barani, the Italian 64th Canzano Division, was cut to pieces after moving into a Napoleonic formation with guns and infantry intermixed in an L-shaped block along the crest of a ridge. Division had no depth and made no effort of concealment and was almost entirely linear and completely vulnerable. The Italian tactical incompetence continued throughout the campaign. In the days leading up to the assaults of Bardia and Tobruk, complete control of no man's land was too readily ceded to the Australians. The Italians rarely ventured into and the far side of the wire, even to investigate obvious disturbances. General Italian defensive procedures and discipline was woeful. Australian patrols, even when they were found active Italian sentries, watched them smoking, talking freely, laughing, and sometimes singing. Poor Italians. When the 6th Division patrols were spotted, many of them purposefully to test the Italian response, defences reacted with high volumes of ineffective fire, habitually set on inaccurate fixed lines, which accomplished little other than to betray the position of various weapons of the attackers. Nor did the Italians ever think to vary the position of their artillery batteries or the strength of their forward defensive lines, which, of course, people did in Tobruk. Broad tactical ineptitude gained initiative to the Australians and, in these two cases, allowed detailed plans of attack to develop from known facts. Civil actions like varying the perimeter posts, which perimeter posts were occupied each day, or aggressive patrolling to deceive and mask points of real strength, or else keep the majority of combat troops back in deep tank-proof creek beds, would have greatly complicated the 6th Division plans. Throughout the campaign, Italian small unit tactics were all but absent. With some notable exceptions, a few local counterattacks were ever arranged. In Italian defensive positions, only in rare instances was mutual support prepared, real fire discipline displayed, or weapon effectively positioned. Indeed, surprisingly, consistent failure to sight weapons properly was an important ingredient in Italian failure at subunit and individual levels. Italian heavy weapons, rarely positioned to offer protection from frontal fire, were commensurately vulnerable. So, too, the sights of captured Italian individual weapons and machine guns were time and again found to have been set too high. Lieutenant Colonel Ether made specific notes of this tendency to explain his unit's low casualty during the campaign. Captain Honor of the 2nd 11th Battalion noticed that his company at Bardia seemed to be living charmed lives that day, particularly as the defenders, in their panic, forget to lower their sights as the attackers come closer. Predictably, given the training advantages enjoyed by the 6th Division, a clear relative superiority of low-level tactical skills was a feature of the Australian operations during the campaign. With time, opportunity and inclination to hone individual and small group drills prior to moving to the front line, very few Australian tactical shortcomings were exposed. Each night, from the time of this battalion's move to Egypt in November 1940, for example, so ingrained were proven tactical principles that despite the distance from the front line, Lieutenant Colonel Evan Doherty sent a company to occupy the high ground near his battalion's location. During the various attacks, dispersion discipline was effective fire and movement, where small groups within the infantry sections advanced under covering fire from their neighbours, saved Australian lives. It was also something of a tactical innovation in line with the extant German practices, but not yet as codified as the standard British procedure. In addition, this is fire movement. That's what you all move in. In addition, combined arms operations using artillery and armour to protect assaulting infantry. Now, I used to have what's those knee pads, soccer knee pads for fire movement. It was just really elbow pads. Yeah, I got so underneath my uniform. Okay. Was applied schematic fatal point of battle in a number of key engagements. Of course, it's possible to identify tactical errors by the Australians in the early days of the Desert Warfare. The overall issue, however, was the obvious gulf between Australian small group tactical proficiency and the procedural incompetence displayed by the Italians' counterparts. As any battle is the sum of the smallest parts, this was a clear advantage for Mackay's men. What does all this discussion of the first Libyan campaign tell us about the idea of Australians were natural soldiers? First, we can be absolutely certain that Australian troops were successful. We can be equally certain, however, that the reason behind the victories had nothing to do with the Anzac mythology or the colourful conceptions about the innate national characteristics. It's perfectly clear, even in a campaign where large-scale successes came so fast and so cheaply, that the Australian volunteers were made into soldiers. They were not born to the job. Their clear and comprehensive relative training advantages over the Italians' adversaries was a key determinant of victory. It was not the only advantage held by the Australians during the campaign, but it was fundamental. It was noteworthy that when the very same Australian troops were pitted against German enemy in Greece and Crete in 1941, whose combat experience and training and preparation narrowed, or in some cases reversed, the balance of this advantage and the outcome was remarkably different. The myth of innate Australian soldiery skills fails to adequately explain such defeats. Ethnicity is never an answer. Australian national character is not a gauge, did not change in Greece, but the battlefield outcomes did. In battle, soldiers die by fire and steel, not by vague conception of race and culture. No enemy was ever mateshipped to death. No objective taken by larrikinism. Anzac is a social construct, a legend, and an inadequate lens through which to view and interpret a real historical events. Removing the fog of Anzac from the interpretation of Australian military involvement in World War II does not, by any stretch, lessen the sacrifice, achievement, and courage of the men who fought. Indeed, it does precisely the reverse. Reviewing the accomplishments of Australian servicemen within the framework of inborn intrinsic combat prowess is one thing. Understanding their achievement as ordinary men is something else. Latter, without obscuring the effect of mythology, does great justice to their legacy. Brilliantly put. That was a brilliant ending. Thanks for listening.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.